while we may no longer sport a mining boom, we can, you know, boast a migration boom. And according to the writer and commentator George Megalogenis, the rise in the better educated and younger migrants from China and India especially will usher in profound changes to Australian society of an order he believes not seen since the gold rushes of the 1850s. George believes we haven't really grasped as a nation that every aspect of policy will be affected, not merely direct immigration policy. And he implores us to scuttle some of our treasured imagery of the battling migrant working endless hours to finally succeed in their adopted land. He's issued a call to arms to elevate migration to a first-order concern within the realm of foreign affairs, to expedite the transition to a Eurasian nation bound neither to the aspirations of our largest trading partner, China, nor to the anxieties of our ally, the United States. His essays, published in the first edition of a new journal launched this week in Canberra by the Foreign Minister. It's independent and non-partisan. It's called Australian Foreign Affairs, and we're delighted to welcome it, as you can imagine, given our focus on this area ourselves. George's essay is The Changing Face of Australia, and I welcome him now to tell us more. Good to have you with us.
How are you, Geraldine?
Very good. Now, this migration and foreign affairs, not necessarily a natural link, but you were clearly asked to try to make one. By the sound of it, it wasn't that hard.
No, in fact, it was an interesting request. So I haven't written much in the foreign affairs space before, but when the editor, Jonathan Perlman, got in touch, he said, I think you've got a story to tell us in the foreign affairs space about Australia. And I actually only took about 2 seconds to figure out that, yes, this was a hot topic for foreign affairs. And it's partly because the rate of change is putting us in a position in terms of our ethnic mix. Our demography is going to force neutrality on our foreign affairs in the next 10 or 20 years, whether we like it or not, simply because of the country we are becoming. Now, that neutrality, a lot of people in the past have talked about it. Whitlam talked about it. Keating talked about it. Malcolm Fraser, after he was Prime Minister, talked about it. Gareth Evans talks about it now. Kevin Rudd's been talking about it now that he's a former Prime Minister. This conversation in the political space was always a bit of a nirvana, I think, because in practical terms, Australia as a sort of Anglo-European nation was always going to align itself with firstly Britain and then the United States. And there didn't seem to be any reason to overthink it. It was what it was. And the only question really was, did you have to get involved in every one of the foreign adventures with the US military? And obviously the question in and around Iraq was that probably wasn't a good one to go to. But the question arises for two reasons. One, because of the way our migration program is functioning. And the other is the shift in the global order. Mm. So the rise of China, with the catch-up from India, the shift in power from the North Atlantic to North Asia. That story is well understood, I think, as a challenge. But when you have the second conversation, this is a conversation I was encouraged to write for this essay, and quite relieved in a way to be able to discuss it with another frame, because this is obviously, you know, home court for me just to discuss the changing face of Australia. The question arises really quickly now. What sort of Australia are we today? What are we becoming? And how does that Australia engage with the world? So if Australia looks more like the region than it ever has before, and power is shifting to the region, what's our role in that region? Is our role in that region as an Asian country or a European country? Or, as I argue in the piece, a more independent Eurasian country.
Well, you paraphrase Paul Keating, our future is not only in Asia, it is Eurasian. But you go on to say something quite challenging. Australia will therefore have to be more assertive and less offensive. Now, what do you mean by that?
It makes so much more sense on the page, doesn't it? You're asking me to explain. Quite a profound thought even for me.
Try.
I think the big question for us is how do we maintain our independence? Now, independence doesn't mean we break off from the United States and go into the China camp. Independence means that China and America looks at us, obviously not as an equal in terms of scale, in terms of size, but a friend to be respected, whose opinions is respected on every issue. So if Australia in a particular argument says to the Americans, maybe the Chinese have a case here, that the Americans won't take offence. So if we tell the Chinese, maybe the American international order ought to be reinforced in this area, that the Chinese don't take offence. That's the primary frame in which I refer to offence.
So it's our sense of, by the sound of it, almost like our sense of our right to sit there in that hybrid way, that we have a genuine belief that that is in our national interest to do that.
To be able to talk to all our friends as equals and to be treated and to be respected as an equal. Again, not in terms of size, but something about us would allow us to talk to both sides.
Now, just...
There's another point to offence. Right. The other point to offence is the way politics is operating at the moment, we're not thinking this way. We're not discussing the foreign policy implications of migration, because at the moment we're still sweating the domestic policy implications of migration, which is the divide and conquer on the electoral map. So we're now running a migration program, a souped-up skilled migration program, literally bringing in every year twice as many people as we did in the 1990s. So from a target of about 80 to 100,000, we've gone up to about 190,000.
It happened really under John Howard's watch, as you say.
Well, John Howard did it, and good luck to him for doing it, because he's moved us to a demand-driven program. So employers and state governments decide who comes to this country, not a cabinet minister. Now, in going from 80 to 100,000 to 190,000 a year, literally that extra 100,000 are carrying skills that the existing population doesn't have. Now, that doesn't mean that they're better than the existing population, but it means they're arriving on completely different terms to, say, the migrants of my parents' generation after the Second World War. The typical migration story of the 20th century, which is well understood, and it's the Southern European story, it's the Southeast Asian story. So a Greek and Italian, former Yugoslavia, Vietnamese, even Chinese and Indian migrants from the 80s and 90s will be able to tell this story to each other. Parents start at the bottom. You measure their success via small business ownership, home ownership.
And hundreds and of hours put in.
Yeah, and then you measure the success of the program via the second generation, the Australian-born. Now, the new arrival in the 21st century is landing on the top of the social structure, not starting at the bottom and waiting for their kids to climb the ladder. They are starting at the top. Now, that migrant can't be treated as some migrants have been treated in the past, you know, told to put up or shut up. Now, that migrant, especially if it's coming from China and India, is going to have a mother country wanting to pay attention to how they're treated. So when I say we don't want to be we want to be less offensive, we want to be more honest in our dealings in foreign affairs, but we also want to be a better host, if that's possible.
Well, you do.
We're not a bad host, but I think we're going to have to speed up the welcome. In fact, we roll out the welcome mat a lot quicker.
Is this very interesting phrase about these new migrant in your terms? Their wealth and power come from who they were in China, not from what they become in Australia. Do you think that the community just has not grasped that this is happening in their midst? Because you say that there's epic changes happening, really nothing seen since the gold rush times in our identity, and we haven't quite grasped it, neither side of politics either?
Both sides of politics will pick this up via the complaint about sort of infrastructure bottlenecks, elevated property prices. Now, they are symptoms, not the causes of the policy dilemma. The policy dilemma is when you're landing this many skilled migrants, how do you engage them? You have to engage them on a completely different level to previous waves. Now, sort of long story short, you can't put them on your Supreme Court bench. You can't put them at the top of your cabinet tree, because that's not the way you would run a migration program. But your business and your cultural institutions should look a lot more like Australia is. Now, that means that the boardroom needs to be open. It means that places like the ABC, certainly places like the traditional press, News Limited, Fairfax, needs to be able to catch this voice as quickly as possible, because it is a significant part of the population. And when I say significant, the Chinese now are the largest immigrant community in Sydney today. The Indians are the largest immigrant community in Melbourne today. The majority of both those groups are more skilled than the local-born population.
And yet, I've got to come in, because you went on an ABS tour of the country, Australian Bureau of Statistics tour of the country, to find out how different the rest of the nation is to that Sydney-Melbourne paradigm you describe.
You know, the rest of the country looks nothing like Melbourne and Sydney today. I mean, there's always been a sort of sense of difference in Melbourne and Sydney. But up until the turn of the 21st century, whether you're a high or a low migration area, you tended to receive migrants in the same order, you know, the English and then the Italians after the Second World War and then the Greeks, you know, 1, 2, and 3, whether you're high or low migration zone. And then in the 70s, it'd be the sort of Kiwis would be up at number two. The waves are breaking, not just in terms of the quantum, so trickle in some areas, tsunami in another, in a good way, they're actually breaking with completely different ethnic faces. So it's Eurasian in the southeast corner. In to the north, Gold Coast, Brisbane, it's Pacific Islander and New Zealand. So the number one immigrant group in Brisbane today and on the Gold Coast are the New Zealanders.
Mm.
Whiz around to Darwin and the Philippine-born are the number one immigrant
Sunshine
group.
Sunshine Coast is very white, you say.
Oh, and in between, yes. Yeah, so the whitest part of Australia is the Sunshine Coast. There is not an Asian face in the top five. Now, that number jumped off the page when I looked at it because I thought, how could I bet it? You go from Eurasian to sort of Pacific to very white, and then when you flip around the corner to Darwin, it's Southeast Asian.
And what
again.
About Perth?
Very English. And in fact, the English born in Perth are at the highest rate as a proportion of the total population than we've had since the White Australia policy.
My goodness. And Adelaide and surrounds?
Well, so Adelaide and surrounds are still the English are number one. And by a long way, mind you. So this is, when we look at population trends, we'll see many more parts of Australia with the China in the southeast corner with the Chinese and Indians.
But not Tasmania?
No, actually, here's the punchline. The Chinese on present trends will be the number one immigrant group in Hobart in the next 20 years. That'll happen. Canberra will have either Indians or the Chinese at the top. As I said, Melbourne and Sydney already have Chinese and Indians at the top. So this country in the next 10 years is going to be very interesting, but also very difficult to hold together politically.
Mm.
So the parts of Australia that aren't connected to this migration boom. So this is when you talk about the end of the mining boom and the take up of this migration boom, the parts of Australia that aren't connected to this migration boom are not going to recognise the rest of Australia, the parts that are connected to it. They're not going to recognise it. And I think that this is a part of the story that we haven't had to confront before in our sort of history as an open settler nation.
And I think what you also say is that our assumptions about, say, a suite of shared values that might implicitly guide foreign policy, for instance, we won't necessarily be able to make those assumptions. And I mean, just last week, or it was 2 weeks ago, I think I interviewed Michael Vatikiotis, who's been a long-time observer of Southeast Asia, 30 years there, and he detects a real drift to authoritarianism. Now, if we're getting quite a few skilled migrants from that area, they might have, I presume this is what you're sort of concerned about, they might have emphases that wouldn't necessarily be the traditional emphasis in Australia.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I want the Welcome Mat to be rolled out even quicker than ever before. I want the integration story to be integration at contact, at arrival. I don't want integration to have to wait a second generation. And in the past, I thought, actually, when you look back on it, we kind of muddled through. We did all right because we're good people. We had a full employment economy that could give a job to my dad and also give a job to my mum. And we had a school system that could put my sister and I through high school and into university without paying fees. Okay, so we look back on that time as a bit of a sort of migration nirvana, but it was a bit of a muddle through too, if you think about it. The challenges and the opportunities are elevated now. There is no muddle through middle path. There is no it'll work out because we're a lucky country. This won't happen if we don't figure out how to make it work. Because if we don't figure out how to make it work, you'll get a significant portion of your population living separately from the rest of the country, not because they're in a jobless sort of ethnic enclave, but because they're living in your very best postcodes.
Or get caught in a pincer of parochialism, to use your little phrase.
Well, yes. And politics essentially ignoring them because, you know, they paid their way to get in. No one's bothered to engage with them, and they're not causing you any trouble, because this is almost a non sequitur, but it actually reinforces the point. The Chinese and Indians in Australia have the lowest imprisonment rates in Australia of any group. So they're not going to be any trouble. But if they don't feel part of the country because you didn't think you needed to engage them politically because they landed with money or they landed with a tertiary degree, you don't want that country to play out, because that country politically cannot be put back together again.
Okay.
Because the losers from this process are going to continue to argue for control. They're going to continue to argue for payback, and they're going to continue to argue for parochialism.
Will we be comfortable in our Eurasian skin, as you asked? George Megalogenis, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Geraldine. Thank you.
And George has written an essay called The Changing Face of Australia. It's published in this inaugural edition of Australian Foreign Affairs, which I think, just as I'm not entirely sure, but I think it's going to be in news agents as well. But have a look out for it. And we welcome your thoughts.